It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, a brand new week of liberal progressive conversation radio begins here on the Horn. Headon.live is where we live on the interweb tubes. It's where you go if you'd like to pick out a screen name and a password, jump into the real-time multimedia madcap wacky zany extravaganza that is the chat room during the 3 hours in which this program is live, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and it's Moran Monday. Yes, indeed. Every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. And so thanks go out over the course of the weekend to David and to Mike in Cascadia, to Joseph, and to Dave in the Blind in Talibandiana, to Sharon, to Carl in Columbus, to Dr. John, to Armand, Vincent, and Bernice. Thanks one and all for being partial sponsors of the program, who, with your subscription, make it possible for us to know that, well, about a quarter of the month's funding is covered on any average monthly basis. If you'd like to be a new subscriber, well, you're mighty welcome to run over to headon.live and click on Contribute and go from there. One more click after that, and you'll be able to make a choice as to whether to part with not quite half the cost of one McDonald's hash brown patty per day by way of keeping independent liberal broadcasting on the air. Okay? So I'll mention it and hopefully not mention it again, because I despise it. The fundraising goal this evening is just a plain old-fashioned $200. 10 at 20, 20 at 10, 1 at 200, 2 at 100, 4 at 50, 8 at 25, 16 at 12.5, 32 at 6.25, and of course 64 at $3.13. And we round that half a penny up and put it into Agnes's fund for the hot spring therapeutic mud bath that someday she'll have here at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion. Okay, $200. And if it gets knocked out, yay. Won't that be just wonderful? But a new Moran Monday week is a dawning. Let's start out with a note from Ron in Raleigh every damn day and twice on Sunday. This weekend, John Woomboom Bolton briefed Miss Lindsay on the goings-on in the Persian Gulf, and would you believe it, he laid blame squarely at the feet of the wild-eyed pistol wavers in Iran. I don't know about you, but I'm shocked. I need someone to explain how you attack four oil tankers and not cause a single oil spill. Why would Iran start some shit with old Woomboom and Mike Pompeo? You know, he finished first in his class at West Point. Great inflation. We went over that. And Bibi Netanyahu spoiling for a fight. Can you say false flag? The Trump administration is sending 120,000 troops to the Middle East. Do these pillocks realize that Iran has a standing army of 535,000 men armed with Chinese weapons? I read somewhere earlier today it was closer to 3 million, but whatever. American hubris is going to get a lot of American soldiers killed. To go off on a tangent while listening to My Filthy Habit, NPR, the latest Democrat to throw his cowboy hat into the ring, Stephen Bullock of Montana, when asked whether he favored single-payer, said he believed that the 115 million people yoked to their jobs by employer-provided insurance liked the situation they're in. What kind of bovine excrement is this guy smoking? Well, just remember, it was Max Baucus of Montana who put the killing stroke to the public option, wasn't it? Back when the ACA was being debated. It had a public option in it. And then somehow Max Baucus of Montana made it go away. Maybe Stephen Bullock is a Max Baucus protege. Mayor Buttigieg, meanwhile, Ron continues, went on Fox and said that Fox viewers aren't going to hear the Democratic message if Democratic candidates don't go on that network, as if any of these brainwashed mouth breathers is about to change their tiny little minds. Anyway, there's more, but I've rambled on enough. I'm looking out my window, and I see some rabbits in the yard. P.S., what's up with the authors with the R.R. middle initials? George R.R. Martin, J.R.R. Tolkien. Just wondering. Well, you know, there's some people out there that you just... you can't put quite enough... just enough heft behind one middle name. You gotta have a second one. I don't even know how to pronounce J.R.R. Tolkien's other R name. Ronald I got. Yeah. Ron and Raleigh, right? Yeah. John Ronald R.E.U.E.L. Tolkien. I don't know if that's royal I got nothing. But, and George R.R. Martin, nothing. That's true. Stephen New York reminding us, Max Baucus, it was even worse than stripping the public option. He wouldn't even allow testimony on single payer. Thank you, Steve from Georgistan. Greetings to the pimp in the box. Thank you, Steve, and have a take and don't suck, since we're going to be doing this Jim Rome thing. if you do pop by, if you pop by the chat room, you will, of course, be immediately greeted by the denizens there gathering together, Anatole, Irish Dave, Otto DeShot, Squeaky, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master with a guest in the man cave, has folded space to become man cave. You'll also be capably moderated by pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. And hey to Tim from L.A., hanging out in the man cave this afternoon in Northern California. Glad you got where you were going, and hope you had an enjoyable trip, and be safe going home. Ooh, that's a... Brother Deacon Ace has been busy. He was pressure washing the his char griller Acorn Kamado, and I tell you what, that thing's looking pretty. All shiny and new looking. It finally had two decent days of weather, Sunday and Saturday. So that meant that on Saturday morning, ribs went in the seasoned brine, and I seasoned the bee Jesus out of it too. Oh, I was just, you know, double checking. You always got to check the unit and check the recipe and everything. Getting ready for the massive smoking of ribs that will take place before I head down to Malloy Fest in the end of the first week of June, which is not that far away now. It worked out nicely. Photos were provided on my Facebook page and over at Instagram and on Twitter. They were real, no, I'm not kidding, they were real good. Really good. So I'm in, you know, I'm in fairly good spirits for the day. I wanted to start with a little something from back in time, because as well. Wait a minute. Let's keep things in their proper order here, shall we?
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. It's Morian Monday on the Horn. You will not believe your ears. What's going on behind this thin, cybernetic veil of canvas that's situated just a few scant yards, perhaps, away from the Carnival Midway, where only moments ago you were throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls in the desperate hope to take home your very own baby iguana that will someday become large enough to eat the family cat. Yes, yes, indeed. It's Moran Monday on the Horn, behind the thin cybernetic veils of the Moran Monday tent, because you can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. Yes, indeed, for, as noted, less than half the cost of a McDonald's hash brown patty, you too can make sure that everyone has access to the Moran Monday tent and every other program throughout the month here in the Horn Family Community Congregation. As you enter the Moran Monday tent, a gentle reminder, friends and neighbors, aunts and uncles, kiddies and cousins, brothers and sisters, keep a close hand on jewelry, wallets, purses, watches, bracelets, rings, necklaces. Yes, they all fall under jewelry, but we want to be specific here. Children, small animals, even that iguana you won throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls, and yes, European style messenger bags, because the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. And it's no joke. But like I said, I wanted to do a little time travel because we're, I've got a story here. It's about a week or so old, but I saved it specifically for Moran Monday because it's almost as though it could be the patron saint story of Moran Mondays. Now let's, the time travel part of it, the real time travel part of it, is a journey back to the pages of one of my favorite books about the modern America, the politics of modern America, and that is, of course, Joe Bajant's Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Long before J.D. Vance had ever been taken under the wing of the Tiger Mom there at Yale, and turned miraculously, this guy who grew up in Ohio was turned miraculously into a hillbilly by some eldritch wizardry I do not fully understand. Joe Bajant was doing a far better job explaining the white folks of Appalachia to the rest of the country. And it happens in Deer Hunting with Jesus. And so in a chapter 8, called American Hologram, the apocalypse will be televised. Joe tapped into, God, I miss him too. Joe tapped into basic issues of literacy in the United States, or illiteracy in the United States. Noting that here in the new 90 states of Merca, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth, now, today, in the universe, forever, under God, amen. Somewhere between 89 and 94 million American adults are functionally illiterate. There's an outfit out there that Joe cites too called the National Institute for Literacy. And they define functional illiteracy as a lack of a sufficient foundation of basic skills to function successfully in our society. Out of that 89 to 94 million human beings, somewhere between 17 and 20% can read a little bitty itsy bitsy bit. Now, they can't write. They can't fill out a job application. They can't comprehend a food label. They can't read a simple bedtime story to their babies. You know, I mentioned in talking about the way we try to fund this program that a $10 a month subscription works out to less than half the cost of a McDonald's hash brown patty. And I noted that because Saturday morning, God knows why, I went in to McDonald's because, well, Ferg had a hankering for hash brown patties. They're two for $2. One presumes that means they're a dollar a piece, but it's McDonald's, so, you know, those assumptions can get you off the rails in a hurry. But they've remodeled the McDonald's over there in Fayetteville. And I don't know if they realized this or not, but the cashier or the clerk or whatever one calls the person who is being insufficiently paid to take one's order, they're down to only two cash registers now, where they used to have four across and no, that's gone because they installed two stupid computerized kiosks, which are just a further aggravation to the people who are being insufficiently paid to do those jobs. But it's the cash registers themselves that caught my attention because, like I said, I don't know if McDonald's realized it was just participating in turning Mike Judge's idiocracy into reality, but there, here we are, and there they are, and there you have it. There are virtually no numbers on this screen. It is comprised almost entirely of pictograms. A picture of two hash browns that is a button that one pushes. A picture of a cheeseburger. A picture of a sausage biscuit. A picture of an Egg McMuffin, because people cannot be counted on to know how to read anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was not a reassuring thing. It just wasn't. I recall one of the pictograms on Mike Judge's Idiocracy Hospital cash register screen showed a baby falling out from between a woman's legs. I guess that meant pregnancy or in labor. You don't really know because there are no words. But anyway, way back years ago, because remember we were still in the dark ages of the reign of error when Joe Bagent was writing this book, he noted that another 25% of that 89 to 94 million Americans, they can read just enough, but can't get all the way through five consecutive paragraphs of text or something like, say, a sales contract. So that was America back in 2006, 2007. I significantly doubt that there has been an upsurge in literacy, even though we had 8 years of Barack Obama. I doubt that that upsurge in literacy accounts for where we find ourselves in the present day. Bajent goes on and says, of course, there's more to literacy than reading words. In our culture, it helps to be able to contextualize an infomercial, not to mention Tom DeLay's crimes. Almost none of the crowd at the Royal Lunch, that's the diner that Joe was fond of there in Winchester, Virginia, even knows who Tom DeLay is. They don't watch the national news unless the United States attacks somebody or there's a flood in New Orleans. Even if they took the trouble to read George Orwell's Animal Farm, none of them would see it as anything other than a story about animals. There really is a tie-in to a current Moran story here, I promise. He says, from inside the American hologram, an eagle is an eagle and a yellow ribbon is a yellow ribbon. Uneducated and trapped within the hologram, people like Carolyn and Bobby will never be capable of participating in a free society, much less making the kinds of choices that preserve and protect one, unless the importance of full literacy can somehow be made clear to them. The problem is they're pretty happy the way they are. Television and movies pump in enough entertainment to give them something to talk about when they're not debating whether the food at Olive Garden is better than the food at Outback Steakhouse. And most of their friends and family are just like them. They're not rebels raised by philosophy scholars, so they don't often rub up against a different way of looking at things. And then he gets to the nub of the issue. Joe was so good this way. He doesn't write about... Well, he writes fondly of these people because they are his neighbors. They are people who will do and help and whatever. But he writes about them not as they wish they were or how they see themselves, but as they are. And he says, anyone who thinks that these white conservatives, both working class and small business class, don't care about anything outside their own zone of ignorance is only half right. The fact is that many of them cannot see outside that zone at all. They're too uneducated, too conditioned to the idea that being a consumer is the same thing as being a citizen. I'll add editorially, there's a reason for that, because it's been equated. Owning stuff, after all, Joe notes, is lots more fun than exercising the duties of citizenship, and according to our president back then, you know, the dim leader, is the most patriotic aspect of citizenship. As we liberals now begin to inveigh against the loss of personal freedoms in the new corporate American state, a much larger freedom has already been lost. The freedom from ignorance. So long as Pootie, Nance, Dottie, and even Bobby remain incapable of reading or grasping what the greatest minds have learned and written, or can't tell the difference between a patriotic country song and a political truth, we aren't likely to make much human progress. No matter how good the economy is or how much stuff we own. This, again, is written during the time before George W. Bush's chickens came home to roost and the economy melted like a doesn't have any real milk in it McDonald's ice cream cone in the heat. To do that, we're going to have to switch off the hologram before economic collapse, peak oil, or the rest of the world does it for us. So that's Joe Bajent and a trip down memory lane. Some, Jesus Christ, it's hard to believe, 13 years or so. Yes, I know. Ron in Raleigh says, reading is boring. Stop telling us how illiterate we are, Bob. That's the problem. I'm not telling the Horn Family Community Congregation how illiterate they are. This is the side of the political spectrum that could solve problems. But we are Oh, Prometheus-like. It was Prometheus, wasn't it? Shoving a rock up a hill, only to have the sumbitch roll back down over us every time we get it almost to the top. Think about Prometheus, though. I mean, according to the Greeks, he's still pushing that rock. Not a lot of give up. Just precious little in the way of return on investment. And so with that as prologue on this Moran Monday, we find ourselves examining a piece of, a data point from some recent survey work done here in the new 90 states of America. It was done as an exercise in trying to suss out. Oh, Sisyphus, there you go. Thank you, Prometheus. Yeah, nope, Sisyphus. Prometheus is busy getting his liver pecked out by a raven or something. Yeah, Sisyphus. Thank you, Glenn. I had a 50% chance, and once, anytime I have a 50% chance, just a heads or tails, I can sit around here and just flip a penny, and it comes up heads, 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 heads. It comes up heads every time I say tails. In complete defiance of the laws of statistics. So, yeah. But anyway, the purpose of the study was to suss out bias among respondents that they didn't know they possessed. It wasn't just, oh, shucks, let's make fun of the maggots. No. It was an attempt to scientifically wrap the investigators' heads around just how prejudiced Americans are, even if they think they aren't. And what a job they did. These questions were, I guess, by definition, trick questions. The market research company Civic Science asked the same set of questions of 3,624 Americans. They asked questions. They didn't provide definitions. They didn't provide clues. They asked simply, in one question, should schools in America teach Arabic numerals as part of their curriculum? 3,624 people were asked that question. Of the 3,624 a majority, a pretty broad majority, answered the question, should Arabic numerals be taught as part of the school curriculum in this country? They said, no, it shouldn't. No, we don't need to be teaching any Arabic numerals. Just let that sink in if you haven't already heard this. That's why I went back to Joe Bagent, because I remembered that passage from Deer Hunting with Jesus about literacy. And I realized, A, those people get to vote, and B, those people vote Republican. Only 29% of the people responding to that question said, yes, we should be teaching Arabic numerals. In classrooms in the United States. 15% of the respondents said they had no opinion. 'Describing the data as it divulged itself, a guy by the name of John Dick, which made me wonder if this was actually some sort of joke, but no, said it was the saddest and funniest testament to American bigotry we've ever seen in our data. I guess it's funny, as long as maybe you're not of Arabic ancestry or heritage. And to be clear, Arabic numerals are the numerals we use every day. I don't have to say that because I'm talking to an intelligent, literate community of like-minded liberals and progressives of goodwill. We call them Arabic numerals because that's who mostly transmitted them, but they were actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 were developed by mathematicians on the Indian subcontinent. And as valuable knowledge will, it traveled and it got to the Arabic-speaking world, at which point it was transmitted into Europe, who were still, I guess, doing long division in Roman numerals, something I can't even conceive. But it seemed perfect for a Moran Monday, because once they teased out the data a little bit more, 72%, which is just 8 points less than the Republicans who support Donald Trump, 72% of Republicans said there's no way, no Arabic numeral should never be in no curriculum. What they found odd, the researchers, was that there was no meaningful difference in the amount of education that people had between the Democrats and the Republicans. Mr. Dick said they answered differently even though they had equal knowledge of our numerical nomenclature. It means that the question is about knowledge or ignorance, but also something else. Prejudice. It wasn't the only question that had a funny-ish notion, because they uncovered some anti-religious bias along the way, too. They asked, should schools in America teach the creation theory of Catholic priest George Lemaître as part of their science curriculum? And people said, well, no. Well, he was a physicist, and he's the guy who came up with the idea of the Big Bang. But I would suggest that between the two, there is a bit of a gulf. Father George Lemaître is not a household name. On the other hand, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 are in use in, I dare say, almost every household in the United States. And not hearing them referred to, even though they come from the Indian subcontinent, not hearing them referred to as Arabic numerals is a little bit shocking. But that's where we are. We live in a country where merely the word Arabic will set off alarm bells in what passes for the minds of 74% of the people who support the President of the United States, Donald Trump. These little games are played from time to time. Penn and Teller, who are pretty much dicks, went around a climate change protest asking if... what was their question? Dihydrogen oxide should be banned. Dihydrogen oxide is, of course, H2O, water. And they found a bunch of well-intended young people who said, well, yes, and I'll sign a petition. This points to a terrifying lack of education in this country. But again, the problem for a pair of libertarian jerks like Penn and Teller is that they were relying on sciencey sounding gobbledygook. These folks relied on prejudice against Catholic priests who have, as the news tell us, a terrible, terrible, terrible sex abuse problem. And so that doesn't really, neither of those really qualify as prejudices that people don't know they have. As compared to having a hissy over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Stephen, New York, subject line, Joe Bagent. If you want to look him up, it's still a relevant book and well worth reading. Joe, B-A-G-E-A-N-T, Deer Hunting with Jesus. Rainbow Pie, his memoir. Well, there's more to be gained out of that than anything J.D. Vance has ever written or ever will. Stephen, New York, says, I have to wonder if we ever really experienced the Halcyon days of literacy. Is the state of things really that different than it's ever been? If not, when did it begin to change? It strikes me that in any society, there's always going to be an educated elite that run things for those that are not as literate. In that regard, we are just not that different than things have been across all societies since time immemorial. I think I beg to differ on that one. If you want to know when things began to change... Well, the right wing would tell you it was when they took the prayer out of the schools. That would be code for actually their real objection that when, you know, Brown versus Board of Education moved this country toward desegregation, which has never really been accomplished. There are those out there who argue that American public schools are more segregated now in terms of sheer numbers than they were at the time of Brown versus Board of Education. But I think you can see the most marked change in education in this country probably beginning with the rise of Ronald Reagan. Because just as they turned mentally ill people out onto the street under the guise of some sort of humane notion of closing state hospitals, when in fact it was just because they wanted the money that the state hospitals were getting to go into Republican crony pockets. So too, education took it on the chin. Bill asks, didn't the number zero come out of the Arabic world? I guess they eventually got around to it, but it was first discovered by the Mayan people. Eventually Europeans did hip to the idea of a numeral that represented nothing, but the Mayans got there first. So it just seemed like a good place to begin our Moran Monday examination, because everything that we talk about cannot help but be informed by the state of ignorance that obtains in this country that once aspired toward greatness. My grandfather did not have a high school education, but his nickname in the Union Hall was the Count. They gave him that nickname, A, because when he wasn't down deep in the bowels of the earth, risking his life and sucking up coal dust, when he had a little free time of his own, he liked to dress as a bit of a dandy. But mainly, they called him the Count because he could cipher in his head real good. And he read quite well. And that was largely the case for a great deal of the community. And we're talking early 20th century here, 1910, maybe, 1908. My other grandfather was a devotee of the notebooks of Elbert Hubbard. They're still in a building somewhere here, full of philosophical mutterings and contemplations from, what was it called? The penmanship school of upstate New York. I can't remember. Crofters. The Crofters. That's what they were. But about the same time that I was exiting my secondary education, it all went downhill real fast under the 8 years of Ronald Reagan, the 4 years of George H.W. Bush, and not a lot of help out of the 8 years of Bill Clinton. Because, we seem to be getting along okay without it. It was, way back in the earliest days of this program when I had a former governor and member of Congress from West Virginia named Bob Wise on the program, and he had left Congress and quit governating and went to work for some think tank on education. And he opined at length about the high school dropout rate and illiteracy. And I was thinking about all these things as I turned on my filthy morning habit today to find that the lead story there at 6A freaking M, war with Iran? Yep. The weekend tweet storm? Not so much, kinda. No, they led with Pete Buttigieg going on Fox News and continued to excoriate. I mean, this is MSNBC, and they're excoriating people who won't go on their competition and raise their competition's fucking ratings. And I knew then that it was going to be all downhill from there. Yep, Ron and Raleigh pointing out, remember when Prop 13 was passed in California and its pernicious effect on education in that state? Didn't experience it directly, but yes. And so the blather was all about how, well, if the Democrats don't go on Fox, how will those independents ever know what their message was? And that's just 16 tons of bullshit. I mean, it presumes all kinds of facts not in evidence, that there are persuadable independents on Fox, that somehow or another Pete Buttigieg scored points, which was later proven to be so much moonshine because, you know, he was on there for 1 hour and Fox has spent all day smearing him, you know, for being a little commie, right? I mean, it's almost as though they had the thing planned from jump to go after him. And so, you know, starting with, Jesus, Fox and Friends. They were having a hissy all day long. But one story just has More and Monday written all over it. And it was when Brian Kilmeade went after Pete Buttigieg over, oh, well, I'm not even going to try to set this up. Get the hockey puck and the duct tape.
Go ahead.
He was very measured when he answers questions in a very thoughtful way. Like, mm-hmm. when they asked him about taking down the memorials, certain memorials like Jefferson, Washington, and he answered, he said, look, if you watch some of these networks, they want to say that I'm going to basically go down and remove the Jefferson, the Lincoln Memorial. And he said, I'm not saying that. Was it the Lincoln Memorial he was talking about? Was it?
No, it wasn't the Lincoln Memorial. Mm. Oh, the moron is strong with these.
Oh, he's talking about Jefferson.
Jefferson. He said,
yeah, the Jefferson. The Jefferson what? Oh, the Jefferson Memorial.
I'm not saying I want to go and remove that one. He said, but I would like to rename some of these streets,
to
maybe
Pete,
after
yeah.
people that,
well,
African Americans.
And here's the danger of this, Ainsley.
Ainsley. They're interchangeable. I guess this is maybe Brian Kilmeade. Brian, he does not have to Kilmeade later. He can Kilmeade now, and I say Kilmeade now. Pronoun trouble. I love the mansplaining here because it's for the ages. It's dangerous, you see, to stop naming things after people who committed treason against the United States. Like there in Arlington, Virginia, where it's no longer going to be the Jefferson Davis Highway, U.S. 1. It's going to be something else. And like I said, I was way out ahead of the curve on that one because it was November of 2017 when I first set eyes on that during one of our trips to work on the AIC Act in D.C. And I remember talking about it here, and I remember looking at my colleague Bo and saying, you know, Jefferson Davis was a fucking Kentuckian and a Mississippian. The only reason they named it is after because he was president of the Confederacy here. There's no argument to be made in favor of naming that highway after that man. It's got to go. And so about, 16 months later, I get proven to be right. And they're going to take that name off that road. Good. Ainslie doesn't understand what fire
rename
she's playing with.
Rename some of these streets, African Americans.
And here's the danger of this, Ainslie. So you say Thomas Jefferson no longer is worthy of having a Jefferson Jackson dinner. Okay. Well, what about Barack Obama? Barack Obama, we love him. Well, did you love him in 2008 when he says marriage between a man and a woman? Did he show intolerance then? Because in 2012 he said same-sex marriage is fine.
You know what Thomas Jefferson never did? Thomas Jefferson, apart from some kind of squishy talk back when he was considerably younger, around about 1776, Thomas Jefferson never really did much in the way of trying to remedy the issue of slavery. He was born a slaver. He died a slaver. He raped a slave repeatedly, got children on her. Yeah, but then again, here we are talking about things that Emery and Marvelline there, in the matching Barca loungers, he raped somebody? Not Thomas Jefferson. Right.
Is he not worthy in 08, and is he worthy in 2012? We're an impossible scale to what he is talking about is instead of saluting our founding fathers, begin to diminish their importance.
Well, hold the fuck on. Since when is Robert E. Lee a founding father? Or Jefferson Davis? Or Stonewall Jackson? Or God knows, Nathan Bedford Forrest? You know, this past Saturday was the fifth anniversary of the passing of our dear friend, Bill Mr. Stress Miller, for whom we have named the Stress Line ever since. And Bill used to talk about the hell that Union General George Thomas caught because he refused to commit treason. There's a reason we're kind of wandering back Civil War-ish here, and you'll understand in a minute. But George Thomas came from a slaver family, and regardless, he honored his oath to the Constitution and to the country, and is probably the least appreciated and greatest general on the Union side. He did more good, great things in the Civil War for which he was unrecognized because others were glory-hounding than anyone else. There's a statue of him atop a horse in Washington, D.C., up at one of the junctures of, I think, Vermont Avenue. It's called Thomas Circle. I remember it because we stayed up that way one time and accidentally found the best damn chicken wings to be had anywhere in Washington, D.C., at a little basement dive bar called Stan's. Huge. Delicious. Not all sloppy buffalo. No, it's just if you get the chance, try it. George Thomas didn't commit treason. Those other Union jackanapes did. But Brian Kilmeade conflates the founding fathers. By the way, Washington freed his slaves upon death. James Madison, as Dr. Bill pointed out today, and wow, make sure you get Dr. Bill's podcast today. He was back after after some travels, and it was obvious that he was ready to roll. And he talks about the view of the meaning of the word property as held by that generation of people who framed the Constitution. It was magnificent, and it's up at podbean.com, and it's up over at whiterosesociety.org. And like everything else here, it's free. But again, Emory and Marveline don't know a founding father from a treasonous Confederate general.
We wouldn't be a country without that.
He took aim at a couple of news outlets, I think Fox and the New York Times as well, because in his original comments with Hugh Hewitt, he was asked about removing the names from the annual Jefferson-Jackson dinner. That was where they started. And then eventually, you know, he went on to say he didn't want Jefferson's name entirely stripped from the public square, but instead honorary titles, for instance, those Democratic dinners. He said last night that that's what he was talking about. So we gave him the opportunity to clarify.
And it was like that all day over there. And you'd think a guy who was a Rhodes Scholar and speaks seven languages might have figured out that he'd be used that way, but apparently not. Well, Ron and Raleigh with a note. I'm sure you heard this weekend Robert Smith, a black billionaire, set up a grant to pay the student loans of the graduating class of Morehouse University. When are the white billionaires going to step up and pay the student loans of the graduating class of their alma maters? I won't hold my breath, nor would I. P.S. I went to Mr. Jefferson's university, and there was little talk of Mr. Jefferson's proclivities vis-a-vis his chattel. Well, no, because we've made a god out of him. If you take the Capitol tour, you'll see that. I mean, it's like the Sistine ceiling, only it's George Washington. It's called the apotheosis of George Washington, meaning George Washington dying and turning into a god. And we've done the same with the rest of them. But you can't get, I mean, any, and it's not just a modern, you're imposing modern understanding. No. Using the standards of the time, the common law, having carnal knowledge of a woman without her consent for the sexual gratification of the committer was rape. And he raped the daylights out of Sally Hemings, as Ron said earlier, all week long and twice on Sundays. But again, you can't be saying that about Thomas Jefferson, even though the living descendants of the rapes are here today. Just are. As Dr. Bill noted earlier today, of the very few slaves that Jefferson ever did free, two of them, well, he freed them because they were his sons. Because Lincoln and Jefferson Davis are equivalent figures in history, I suspect he was talking about a Jefferson Davis memorial. Kinda. But they were both presidents. Jesus. Steve asks, are these fuckers really using the term Jefferson to imply that Mayor Pete wants to get rid of references to Thomas Jefferson rather than what Mayor Pete meant, Jefferson Davis? No, he meant Thomas Jefferson. Things like the annual Democratic dinner, that's the JJ dinner. I've been to a bunch of them. The Jefferson Jackson Day dinner. It's the annual fundraising dinner of a state Democratic Party. It should probably long ago have been replaced with the FDR JFK dinner. But it just kind of goes to show you how hard it is to change entrenched attitudes. Jefferson was vicious, mean, some ways Trumpian, made himself out to look richer than he was, weird sexual proclivities, or at least not the sort that one would talk about around the dinner table. And a willingness to do almost anything to get back at his perceived political enemies. James Wilkinson was the head of the United States Army, such as it was, in the West, and had been known pretty much, it wasn't a very well-kept secret, that he was in the pay of the Spanish crown. And there's evidence to suggest that Jefferson was made aware of it and looked the other way until such time as he decided to work his vengeance against Aaron Burr and relied on Wilkinson's testimony of Burr's treasonous conduct, at which point Wilkinson's treasonous conduct came out into the light, and his attempt to have Burr murdered in the name of the state, it fell all to pieces. Morans. So, morans being morans, and I told you that there would be a reason for all these references, let's wander over into the weeds of the law, because there was an interesting court opinion rendered today in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. A judge by the name of Amit Mehta issued a ruling in the case of Donald J. Trump et al. Versus Committee on Oversight and Reform of the United States House of Representatives et al. And it did my heart good when I read this opinion. Sometimes court opinions are sort of dry and dusty. But Amit Mehta is a student of American history. And I said we'd loop back and we'd understand why I was even making mention of Civil War stuff. Well, because Judge Amit Mehta did. Yeah, really. He reached way back into history to March of 1860. James Buchanan, one of the worst presidents the United States, and see, this isn't lost on me, and hopefully won't be lost on our community. James Buchanan was one of the worst presidents the United States ever had, because he had an opportunity to forestall the bloodshed and slaughter that would attend places like Shiloh and Antietam and Gettysburg. But because of, even though he was a Pennsylvanian, his sympathies lay with the slavery South. In fact, it has been suggested that he carried on a rather lengthy love affair with a Southern senator by the name of Rufus King, for whom King County, Washington was originally named. The other senators and members of other members of the House had a nickname for Rufus King. They called him Nancy. And in an era when men slept in the same bed with other men, and apparently rather frequently, Rufus King was inseparable from James Buchanan. And so, as James Buchanan's presidency was winding down, and it was becoming more and more apparent which way the country was headed, and facing a re-election effort in November of 1860, James Buchanan took exception to a committee in the United States House of Representatives who were seeking documents to support the question of whether or not the Buchanan administration had exercised undue influence on the Congress. The name of the committee was the Covode Committee. And in his opinion, Judge Mehta opens his introduction with the following quote from James Buchanan. "I do therefore solemnly protest against these proceedings of the House of Representatives because they are in violation of the rights of the coordinate executive branch of the government and subversive of its constitutional independence, because they are calculated to foster a band of interested parasites and informers." Well, you know, if Donald Trump knew the word parasite, wow. "And informers ever ready..."
You know, rats. I call them rats, not informers. Too big a word, informers. I call them rats.
"Foster a band of interested parasites and informers ever ready for their own advantage to swear before ex parte committees to pretended private conversations..."
Fake news.
"...between the president and themselves, incapable from their nature of being disproved, thus furnishing material for harassing him, degrading him in the eyes of the country." Trump was tweeting about the not nearly as good a words, but the same complaint this very weekend. So, with the caveat that, yes, I have been known from time to time to play the occasional Led Zeppelin and Beatles and Pink Floyd record backwards, I can't help but see a message there for Trump. And Judge Mehta, with that as his point of departure, points out this case in which James Buchanan objected to being investigated by the Congress. He said the only way you could do it was through impeachment. Now, where have we heard that before? He maintained that the House of Representatives possessed no general powers to investigate him except when sitting as an impeaching body. Buchanan feared that if the House were to exercise such authority, it, quote, "would establish a precedent dangerous and embarrassing to all my successors, to whatever political party they might be attached." The very next paragraph, Judge Mehta writes, "Some 160 years later, President Donald J. Trump has taken up the fight of his predecessor," and then goes into a recitation of the history of the House Oversight Committee via Representative Elijah Cummings trying to lay hands on his financial records going back as far as 2009, his Trump's. Well, it didn't work out particularly well for the Trump team today. Because not only did Judge Mehta rule summarily against their lawsuit against Cummings and the House committee, not only did he reject every argument that they made and provided chapter and verse for why the pettifoggers who went in there, I mean, hell, the check cleared. They didn't care if they won or lost. Now the check's going to clear some more while they run it through the D.C. circuit. And then the check will clear some more, assuming that Trump has the money to pay, which they probably do because the Republican National Committee has, as we've found out in the past, been turned into a money laundering operation for Trump's legal woes. I mean, these lawyers, they had to know they had a loser. But again, they were crafting pleadings for an audience of one, and that was their mistake because the audience for whom they were crafting their pleadings was not the one person who mattered, namely Judge Mehta, but the nitwit Nero not far away at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. What it boils down to is that Judge Mehta, over the course of 41 pages, goes to great pains to deconstruct every argument of the plaintiffs and say, you lose. But that was not the end of it, because the other thing they did, the pettifoggers for Trump said, well, at least, you know, you should give us a restraining order so that this subpoena doesn't go into effect until this thing's been fully litigated. And like a yogi taking apart a spider's web and one thread at a time and putting it back together again, he rolled that one up sideways and stuck it up them too. And broke it off, he said, mixing metaphors. I don't think you can break off a spider's web. History has shown that congressionally exposed criminal conduct by the president or a high-ranking executive branch official can lead to legislation. The Senate Watergate Committee, ooh, Watergate reference. I wonder if he's going to wave this order around and say, no collusion. No, he'll probably attack Judge Mehta for being not sufficiently merkin. The Senate Watergate Committee provides an apt example. Oh, shit. It's not just a reference, it's an apt reference. Oh, dear. That committee's express mandate was to investigate the extent, if any, to which illegal, improper, or unethical activities were engaged in by any persons acting either individually or in combination with others in the presidential election of 1972 or in any related campaign or canvass conducted by or on behalf of any person seeking nomination or election as the candidate for the office of president. Then he points out that as a result of all of that investigation, they passed a bunch of laws, Congress did, thus pointing out that as the oversight committee had pointed, had themselves noted, the reason they want to see Trump's business dealings is to find out if A, he's done anything illegal, B, whether the laws of this country need to be improved or modified or adjusted to deal with having a snake oil salesman in the White House. And I'm hard-pressed to see, absent just pure boot-licking, lick-spittle political patronage, how a court above Mehta is going to overturn this. But most important, one of the most important things happens beginning about page 38. where the judge writes, at the May 14th oral argument, plaintiffs asked the court to stay the return date of the subpoena beyond the 7 days already agreed upon by the parties, pending final appellate review by the D.C. Circuit. Uh-oh, he got his rule book out. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 62C authorizes a district court to issue an injunction pending appeal. Okay. To obtain a stay pending appeal, the moving party must establish that he is likely to succeed on the merits, one. Two, that he's likely to suffer irreparable harm in the absence of preliminary relief. Three, that the balance of equities tips in his favor. And four, that an injunction is in the public interest. I wonder if Judge Mehta felt urgency about getting this out there before the shooting can start with Iran. Because once he gets his war on, they're all going to be hooting about, oh, you can't trouble the commander-in-chief. He's so busy running the war. Because that's another thing he did this weekend. He promised to end Iran. To which Iran responded by referring to his foreign policy advisors as the B-team. No shit. But Judge Mehta said, you know, the court balances all of these factors on a sliding scale so that a strong showing on one factor could make up for a weaker showing on another. Plaintiffs have not shown that their challenge to the Mazar's subpoena presents serious legal questions going to the merits, so serious, substantial, difficult as to make them a fair ground of litigation and thus for more deliberative investigation. But then he throws him a bone and says, but there will be irreparable harm because that which has been held in secret will no longer be in secret. But it must have really hurt when they read it and saw where he said that none of the three grounds upon which plaintiffs challenged the subpoena rests on potentially persuasive authority. In other words, they just yanked it out of their ass. Plaintiffs have cited no case since Kilburn from 1880 in which the Supreme Court or the D.C. Circuit has interfered with a congressional subpoena because it either intrudes on the law enforcement prerogatives of the executive or judicial branches, seeks personal information unrelated to a legislative purpose, or demands records that lack pertinency. This case does not merit becoming the first in nearly 140 years. He deals with the irreparable harm issue. And then says the court is not naive to reality, a reality confirmed by the fact that the Oversight Committee has said that the decision whether to make the records public lies within its discretion. There's a chance that some records obtained from Mazars will become public soon after they're produced. The second factor of irreparable harm, therefore, favors a stay. Uh-oh. Then the final two factors, the balance of equities and the public interest, merge when, as here, the government is the opposing party. These factors tip the balance in favor of denying a stay. And he explains why. Quoting from previous cases, to grant the injunction appellant's request, this court would be required to interfere with the operation of Congress and also to depart from traditional doctrine concerning the availability of equitable relief. The same would be true in this case. Thus, for the foregoing reasons, the court will enter judgment in favor of the House Oversight Committee and against plaintiffs. The court denies plaintiffs' request for a stay pending appeal. A separate final order accompanies this memorandum opinion, dated May 20th, 2019. What does that mean? That means that the subpoena is returnable in 7 days. And there is no stay. Donald Trump loses again. Because that's what he is. He's a loser.
Oh, I'll never settle the Trump University suit.
Ain't settled. Settled. Lost. And this has got to be a little bit disturbing for Steve Mnuchin. Because he has wagered his career on being able to get away with this kind of behavior. His career as Treasury Secretary. His desire to not spend any time wearing an orange jumpsuit and orange plastic shower sandals. So there's no stay. It will go up and be reviewed by the D.C. Circuit. I would find it delightful if the person doing that review was one Merrick Garland. And then, of course, it will go up to the Supreme Court of the United States, where, well, it's anybody's guess. But called upon to do the right thing, one man did. And that is U.S. District Court Judge Amit Mehta. Good for him. Indeed. The passage in there in which he describes not interfering with the business of Congress is at odds with something that Dipshit Donnie recently declared. He has no functional understanding of how government works, because he said in a babble to some reporters live with the cameras rolling that his regime is trying to get laws made, but they're having a hard time getting them through the courts as quickly as they would like. The courts, as any good, God-fearing, upstanding Republican could tell you, are not in the business of making laws. The Congress is. Who, on the other hand, is remotely surprised by the fact that Donald Trump has no idea how government works. He wants to rule by fiat. He wants his word to be law. Darlene in Connecticut with a note. Unfortunately, the judge has the wrong sounding name, so will probably be a target of Trump's ire. Well, yeah, but it's going to make things really uncomfortable for anybody trying to overturn him after he starts sliming at him. Here, let me fire up Twitter real quick and see if he's gone after him yet. This is also not good news for the fact that he, Julius Geezer, has commanded Don McGahn to ignore a subpoena in his own right. Of course, Donald Trump won't be there answering the bar complaint on McGahn's behalf, and they will be filed. There have been a flurry of bar complaints against Lindsey Graham over his statements advising Don Jr. to ignore a duly authorized congressional subpoena. Unfortunately, he's going to hold one of his Clavern rallies in Montoursville, PA this evening. What do you want to bet? He goes after Judge Mehta in this one. Would it surprise you? Meanwhile, with regard to Don McGahn, Representative David Sicalean of Rhode Island, who is a member of the House Judiciary Committee and is chair of the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, which is part of the political leadership of the House, went over on MSNBC and had some rather strong language relative to Don McGahn.
Let me just start on this news. You had the hearing scheduled for tomorrow. Your committee, you were hoping to hear from Don McGahn. The White House is now saying they're telling him not to show up. What do you do now?
Well, obviously, we hope that Mr. McGahn will appear tomorrow. This claim of immunity, which is really a newly created claim, I think the White House recognizes executive privilege doesn't apply since Mr. McGahn testified for 30 hours. And, of course, you can't apply executive privilege after you've disclosed the communications. So now they're making this really broad claim that essentially says the president and his team are immune from ever coming before Congress. That's legally incorrect, and certainly a court will ultimately have to decide that. But I think, let me be clear, if Don McGahn doesn't testify, it is time to open an impeachment inquiry. The president has engaged in an ongoing effort to impede our ability to find the truth, to collect evidence, to do our work. And this is preventing us really from ultimately finding the facts and doing our work in terms of oversight. And I think we now have seen a pattern where the White House is continuing an effort to really impede our search for the truth. No one is above the law, including the President of the United States. And we expect Mr. McGahn to come before the committee and testify.
Let me just make sure I heard you correctly there. If McGahn does not show up tomorrow before your committee, you say it is time for Democrats to begin an impeachment proceeding.
An impeachment inquiry, absolutely. We are really left with no other choice. This is a president who, according to the Mueller report, engaged in 10 acts of obstruction of justice, who tried to get witnesses on his staff to lie, who has attempted to impede this investigation in very fundamental ways. And every effort that we made to collect evidence, to produce documents, to hear from witnesses, this White House has blocked. And there comes a point that we're left with no choice but to begin an inquiry so that we can actually get the information we need to make an informed judgment at the end of that process.
Doesn't seem to have just a whole lot of weasel room in it, does it? Sorry about that. These things happen. No, that's a fairly clear statement from someone who, you know, Now, I don't know how many people will holler goddamn neoliberal establishment shills over that, too, but they've been pushed into it. And I think all along that that's how they wanted it to look. That's how it needed to look. That they had been driven to it. Not that they were eager for it. That they pursue it more in sadness than in anger. Because that is a hell of a lot easier message to sell to, you know, a country that's at least one-third functionally illiterate. Ah, Steve in New York pointing out what sucks about Lindsay is that the bar license is gone inactive. That doesn't mean they can't take it away, though. Oh, no, far from it. So we have reached the halfway program, or the halfway mark of the program, and let's run over to the stress line and see what Scott's got going on. Hey, Scott. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, you're there, Scott.
I must be going.
Yeah, there, Scott. What's up? Scott, I heard you.
Dum, dum, dum.
Scott.
Da-dum.
Okay, just a second here. All right. Do you hear me, Scott? Drop the Bluetooth. There we are. Do you hear me?
I hear you now.
Okay, good, good, good.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay.
You're the daddy-o of the radio, baby.
It's been a lovely day.
Has it?
Always puts me in a better frame of mind.
We are in a very strange situation here in San Diego. Normally, I think I've told you about this before. We have May gray, wherein the month is usually overcast and coolish. But we've been getting a tremendous amount of rain this May. So I don't know. It's been downright chilly for this time of year. And then coming in June, we have what's known as the June gloom.
Well, be glad, like, just be glad you're not in Texas and Oklahoma, because...
Oh, I know.
Virtually unprecedented potential tornado activity.
It's crazy. I mean, I have friends down in Texas, and I have friends in Oklahoma, and friends in Missouri, and Ohio, and Kentucky, and I see these reports on the news, and it's like, geez. Did I ever tell you about the time I was as close as I ever care to be to a visiting tornado? I was still living in Cincinnati, and I'm watching something on TV in the dead of night on cable, and the weather alert automated warning thing breaks through saying that there's one headed out of Indiana going from west to east, and they were showing the projected line of the tornado. This was like 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. So they said it's expected to go toward, what's the name of that town? Blue something, one of these suburban towns northeast of Cincinnati. And damned if it didn't hit. But that damn thing, I stood out on the front porch of the condo where I was living, and that thing passed by about 2 miles, mile and a half to the north of me, and you could actually feel the wind pressure changing, the air pressure, as that thing passed by. It was the eeriest damn thing, and calm and quiet, you know, no noise associated with us, with it at that distance. But, yeah, it went to blue, whatever it was, which it was a little further to the east. And I think it knocked a suburban house down, one of these brick houses, like McMansions, and killed a couple of people. Jesus, what a mess. I'm glad I don't have to contend with Tornado Alley anymore.
Yeah, all you've got is earthquakes, wildfires, and
mudslides. Yeah. Well, those are our seasons here in California.
Yeah, that was blue ash, according to Native Ohio blue, Steve in New York.
Blue ash. I've been out here now for almost 19 years, and you forget some of these things.
In the dead of winter, I wonder, do they say it's blue ash cold?
Well, I don't know. I bet you they do, if they're feeling especially whimsical, you know? Well, I've been sort of out of the loop, which is why you haven't heard from me for...
No, I wondered where you were Friday.
Well, today was the inspection from the housing people.
Ah.
Okay? And I am not known for my housekeeping skills. I mean, my idea of housework, Bob, is to spray a little end dust on Chirps the cat and chase her under all the hard-to-reach places. I mean, that's pretty much it. I'll take the trash out and, you know, stuff like that every so often. But I'm not, and I've kind of let the place go in the almost 2 years that I've lived out here. I mean, it's livable, but it's not really exactly presentable. But nobody ever comes over anyway, so what the hell? But I figured for the inspection, I'd have to launch into a massive cleaning campaign, pitching and sorting and rearranging furniture and all this happy crappy, which is what I was doing for this past week. And it seemed endless. Have you ever engaged in a project that when you're mapping it out in your mind ahead of time, you say, well, I'll do this on this day, and I'll do that on that day, and then this room will be done.
Yeah,
and then
for 15 years.
Okay, well, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But I'll tell you, Bob, I was up all night still working. I got the bathroom finished, and I finished the bedroom, and I finished the living room close to a week ago, and it's looking pretty good. You're going to have to come over, and we'll cook out or do something wild. But I finally got the kitchen done, and that was like 20 minutes before the guy showed up. I was apparently first on his list. They said to be ready between 7:30 in the morning and like 4 in the afternoon. It could happen at any time. And sure as hell, he comes to the door about 7:40 this morning. And he was in and out of here in less than 10 minutes. And I said, well, that's it? He said, that's it. You passed. So I'm good for another two years.
Well, better to be over-prepared than under, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah. And anything that I did in preparation would have been an improvement on how it was. I wish I'd taken a picture. But I've got my VHS deck set up. I don't think I've had it working since I've lived here, okay? And I've been going through, what I would do is I think I told you this once, I, over the years, am not good at marking, labeling videotapes. Like, I'll record something off a cable or whatever, or a movie, but it's either mislabeled or not labeled at all. So it's a total crapshoot. Grab a cassette, shove it into the VHS deck, hit play.
Wonder what you get.
Who knows? Oh, God, who knows what you're going to see? So I've got a stack of maybe 18 tapes. What I would do, I would put one in, hit play, and listen on the headphones as I was puttering about, because I can hear all the audio through these wireless headphones. And I'm amazed at some of the crap that I've captured on videotape. But I've got so far about 18 labeled and accounted for. So that means there's only about, oh, I don't know, 150 VHS tapes yet to be cataloged. You want to come help?
I think I would rather have dental work done with rusty nails.
Well, there you go. That's how I am about organizing. But see, I have a goal now that I've got it more or less set up fairly well. It's just a matter of maintaining it. You know, an hour a week, and it'll stay okay as long as I'm diligent. But man, I'm a pack rat.
Yeah, that's hard to get over.
Oh, I know, and I come by it honestly. When my dad died in '95 and my mom died in '97, and they had by that point, they had been in that house since I think 1956. And my mother's big thing was going to flea markets and yard sales and thrift stores, looking for the bargains, Bob. And they never threw anything away. Down in my dad's workshop in an old Wilkins coffee can, that's a local brand of coffee in the D.C. area, I think now defunct, one of the big cans, like 3 pounds of coffee in it, on a shelf in my dad's basement workshop. We opened it up, and there was every pair of prescription eyeglasses that my parents ever wore. Now, I don't know why they were saving them. Maybe they were going to donate them to... there used to be a charity that collected...
Were they Depression-era people?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I know.
Well, there's your answer.
That's what it was. But I went back to D.C., and my younger sister came down from Maine, and my younger brother was living next door to where I grew up at the time. My older brother was basically, the house was left to all the siblings, and he decided he wanted to buy it, so he had to buy us out. And in order to do that, he had to straighten it up. And we launched into that project for a little over a weekend, like a 4-day weekend. And that was a tremendous thing, getting all that straightened out. I mean, the stuff, Bob. And one thing that I did get out of it, and I don't know the story of it, but there was a little painting. And it was a little landscape, maybe about 12 inches wide by maybe 8 inches high. And there was the person's name and a dash and then 17, indicating it was painted in 1917. And I have no idea how it came into my mom's possession, but it was by an artist by the name of John Liello. And I found a couple of little items online about him. So I called the library, and they looked in one of their art, Who's Who of Art books. And they said he was a moderately famous American painter from the early 20th century. So after I moved out here, shortly after, Antiques Roadshow came to... San Diego. And the weekend before that, they would let viewers of the public station here bring whatever they wanted. They wouldn't be on TV, but it was just sort of a service for the viewers if you have something and you want to get a sense of what it is and what it might be worth. Well, it turns out this painting, this little dinky landscape by John Liello, the guy said, on a good day, you'd probably get anywhere from $17 to $2,000 for it. And it came a point where I had to sell it, and I didn't get anywhere near that because I went about it the wrong way. I took it to an antique store, and the guy kind of ripped me off, but I needed the cash at the time, So that's what I did. Am I talking too much? I think I've got so much coffee running through my system, Bob, that I can.
Well, you're certainly a wellspring. You're a wellspring of conversation, but that's no different than any other.
Yeah, but I'm not letting you talk, and it's your damn show.
Well, I get to talk as much as I want to.
Well, that's true. So I've kind of been out. Yeah, long story short, I've been out of the loop with the Horn program. And only marginally watching the news and reading the, you know.
Oh, it's probably a nice little break, really.
Oh, what a mess. Who does he think he's kidding? Well, you talk about the judge.
Well, the judge business, I was, Dave in South Carolina, Stan, said, I was looking for it, I can't find it, but I was, Trump says he can appeal the ruling about his finances
because it was made by an Obama judge. So the ruling's not valid. It's a fake ruling.
Oh, man. Doesn't he, has he, or the people around him, have they not imparted unto him a sense of recent American history?
No. No, I mean, you could, you know, Annie Sullivan could take little Helen out to the well and pump water on her hands and spell water into the palm of her hand. Because yeah. Back before she got scarlet fever, she had begun speaking and had some memory of hearing. That does not apply to Donald Trump. He has never known what he doesn't know.
Mr. Trump, do the name Richard Nixon ring a bell, a faint little tinkle in your ears?
I mean, if you go and you read the judge's opinion, you're gonna. I suspect you will see what I saw.
Oh, I'm sure.
And that is, namely, that, and it's at courtlistener.com.
Okay.
And it's Trump versus Committee on Oversight. But if you read it, you'll see that this was written especially for Trump and for the people who so blindly support him.
Oh, I'm sure.
There are, you know, the allusion to Buchanan. To Nixon.
Was it? Did you say it was 1823 the last time a court didn't?
No, 1884.
And
the Buchanan business was 1860.
Mm-hmm.
Further proof that even if you're not interested in history, history will find a way to be interested in you.
Yeah.
But the fact that that James Buchanan referred to Congress people investigating his business, referred to them as parasites and informers, pretended private conversations. I mean, really, just this weekend he was saying,
the New York Times, which will collapse as soon as I'm not president anymore in 6 years.
Right.
Trump will be worm food, and the New York Times will be continuing to publish in some form.
Well, somehow or another, the New York Times has managed to survive rather a long while through a whole bunch of presidents.
Bob, it's as if Trump feels the axis of the universe passes through his navel, and that all of it revolves around him. I mean, you've got the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Now, you and I know this. You've been to college. I barely made it through high school. And even I know this, that it's like checks and balances and co-equal branches of government. I mean, I bet you could get a 10-year-old and set them down and ask them to give a short discourse on the branches of government, and they could probably do a fairly adequate job for their grade level. You know? What is a 10-year-old? In fourth grade, fifth grade, something like that?
Yeah, that's about fourth grade.
You know? And it's astounding. It's almost entertaining in a sad, sad way. He has no grip or grasp of of reality, because that old axis of the known universe is running right through his navel, and it all revolves around little Donnie. You know? Of course, now I'm not telling you something you don't already know, but one wonders just how far it will go before somebody puts the brakes on this.
Well, and of course, over the weekend, everybody had a baby over Justin Amash saying what he said.
Yeah, now, for those who are not familiar with him, he's a member in good standing of the Freedom Caucus.
Oh, yes.
He's no liberal, you know?
No, but he has from time to time taken positions contrary to that of the so-called mainstream of his madder than the March Hare Tea Party Republicans, what have you.
But isn't that part of what a congressman or a congresswoman does?
You would think.
I mean, isn't the job designed?
But by God, we despise them on our side when they go and do that. Like, you know, my senator Joe Manchin.
Yeah.
You know, we recall it, but sure. Yeah, but the problem is, Amash got the band in Boston treatment from Trump, mm-hmm. which catapulted the visibility of his arguments. Basically, he posted four theses, and number four was that very few people in Congress have actually read the Mueller report, which I have no problem believing at all,
mm-hmm.
because Republicans don't dare.
Well, Trump himself, I'm sure, hasn't read word one. If they came out with a classic comic...
He can't read.
Well, no. If they came out with a classic comic book version of the Mueller report, he wouldn't pick it up and look at it.
I hope you didn't think I was being facetious there.
No, I know. I'd love to see his college and high school and grammar school. You know how the teacher, at least in grammar school... you'd get your report card at the end of the year, and the teacher, there's a little space on the back that says teacher's comments.
Oh, yeah.
Did they have that when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure the teacher's comments during little Donnie's early education would be an interesting bit of reading.
That was always what I turned to. It's like, there's the grades, okay. Okay, didn't hate me. Good.
Yeah.
but I'm not being facetious.
No, I know you're not.
He can't read. Too many people have testified to that fact. He can barely handle cue cards. The reason he goes off planned scripts is because he can't cope with them. He struggled through guest hosting Saturday Night Live.
I remember that.
But just to go back to the business with Amash for a minute, I got a story in front of me here of exactly, I kind of knew this was going to happen, because now the multimillionaire for-profit media are out there hooting that somehow Justin Amash is better than Nancy Pelosi, when the fact of the matter is they are. They're playing the long game.
Yeah.
It looks like they're being driven to impeachment, because maybe this is counterintuitive, I don't know, but I'm firmly convinced that Donald Trump desperately wants to be impeached.
You think?
Because he thinks that it will inflame the base,
yeah,
and that it might save his ass. So naturally, over there on MSNBC, you've got John Heilman saying, "There's not a Democrat, I believe, not one, who doesn't believe the president hasn't committed impeachable offenses on the basis of the Mueller report. Not one." Democrats basically say, well, the president's a bad guy, may have broken the law, the president has maybe committed impeachable offenses, but we have to get to the bottom, maybe we should impeach, maybe later we'll impeach. The president says no collusion, no obstruction. He's winning the argument because he's strong and wrong, but he's strong and clear. Oh, for fuck's sake.
And so he's basically calling the Democrats a bunch of lily livered sissies because they won't run out and start shooting before they see the reds of his eyes.
Yeah.
The beads of his eyes, I guess.
Well, I like the, in a sense, I like the game that the Democrats are playing, in that they see the limited possibilities of conviction should they achieve impeachment in the House. So they're getting all the information out to the extent they can get the witnesses to show up in these various House panels. And really, that might be, out of that may come, you know, clear and present indications that, you know, that they in fact do have the goods on the guy. Could he be impeached for his beliefs regarding climate change? Is that an impeachable offense?
Impeachment is a political process. An impeachable offense, as we learned in the 90s, is anything that Congress says it is.
No, I don't mean in a GOP Newt Gingrich bullshit kind of way. I'm talking about, we're living in a world now where we've got 12 years to do something, and by God, to do it right in a moonshot sort of way. You know, time is of the essence, okay? And here we've got somebody who not only is just dumber than a box of rocks, but says, you know, climate change is a Chinese hoax. At least that's what he was saying for a while. And he's surrounding himself in cabinet positions with people who are undermining every good thing that was ever done in defense of the water and the air and the land and the environment and the lives of millions of American people. And the world, really, when it comes right down to it. So you've got this guy taking that approach, and the clock is ticking. You talk about you remember the nuclear doomsday clock. Well, we've got an environmental doomsday clock that's ticking quite loudly, thank you very much. You know? And he's putting us at mortal risk.
Well,
because not
in the general context of how the framers viewed impeachment, it was they enumerated specific crimes for which he could be impeached: treason and bribery, okay, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And within that subheading, high crimes and misdemeanors are breaches of public trust, violations of the law. So, you know, if you see ignoring the future of this country as a breach of the public trust, sure. In fact, he's running his mouth right now. Let's check in.
One of the worst fiascos from our former leaders was the disaster of NAFTA. All buildings in Pennsylvania, in New England, all over, they were a total, they're empty. And even to this day, some were converted to nursing homes, some were taken over, but you still see the shock of what they went down. And now we're replacing them with brand new, beautiful buildings. We've got it up. We've got it working again. All over the country, we're building plants and factories like actually never, ever before. Nearly two decades ago, the same politicians who gave us NAFTA also voted to admit China into the World Trade Organization, a disastrous, really, decision. I mean, that was a disastrous decision.
Was it disastrous for Ivanka?
Was it more disastrous than the events of November of 2016? That was pretty disastrous.
Well, yeah.
And as Lee points out, in New York, 900 prosecutors said that Trump committed obstruction of justice. If that's not enough, what the fuck is?
Well, that number keeps growing. I remember the first day they did this, it was like, what, two or three hundred?
Yeah.
And that wasn't long ago. That was like, what, two or three weeks ago?
Right.
They'd almost be, have an easier job of it to make a list of people who don't think. You know, prosecutors who don't think, that's a smaller number to contend with. I just don't know, Bob. I would like to think that there is some way out of this, but I'll be damned if I can see it. And the more, where is he, up in Pennsylvania somewhere?
Yeah, Montoursville. I think that's over toward the western side of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you've got I don't know that you would call that demographic the cream of the proverbial crop.
Well, the problem is he's hemorrhaged voters in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the Biden people are beating on is that Biden is running at about 11 points better than him in a head-to-head polling in Pennsylvania.
Well, that's pretty good. But see, and I know that we shouldn't beat up on candidates, but I do wonder aloud sometimes. A week or so ago, Biden was talking about getting back to normal. Well, then you've got to ask, well, what constitutes normal? If normal is defined by the Democratic version of enriching the already obscenely wealthy and you know, cozy deals and stuff, I just don't see him as someone who is going to – he doesn't seem to be committed to take the type of steps that we need, because what we need, I think, is something way beyond normal. We've been doing what passes for normal since the age of Reagan. We've gotten so cattywampus and twisted and shifted away from normal, thinking back to better days when the government was responsive and was proactive, whether it had to do with civil rights or the war on poverty, and all that shit got derailed. And nobody even realizes that they've torn up the tracks. There's no chance of getting the train back on the tracks because they've torn up the tracks and made a parking lot or a I don't know. I mean, I understand the sentiment that we need something other than a mindless, continually spouting moron as the chief executive of the land. But that's almost a half measure in a way, because normal in terms of what that has become is not a high bar when you think about it. Yeah, that's just, in previous conversations, we've talked about the fact that not only would we have to elect someone and both houses of Congress to put the brakes on the madness, but then you play catch up for the last 30, 35 years, going on 40 years, of all the shit that didn't get attended to in any meaningful way during that 30 or 35 or 40 years. Yeah, I mean, you get what I'm saying there?
Sure.
So whoever it is, they A, need to be electable, but beyond that, they need to be conversant in the state of things for most people in this country. And by most people, I'm thinking the poor, the disadvantaged, and the former middle class. You and I both remember a time when you didn't necessarily need a college education to go out and get a job that you were in for a good number of years, decades even, that had a living wage and good benefits. And it was a single income sort of thing. But the wife didn't have to necessarily work unless she wanted to. And you could take your 2 weeks of vacation, go down to the lake or whatever. You know, you could send your kids to college. What happened to my country? I would hate to think that it was all an illusion and a temporary thing.
It kind of was. That's why I started out the program talking about Joe Bagent. You know, if you read Rainbow Pie, it was never anything but an illusion. There was a brief period of time where, you know, and it's post-World War II, when the middle class rises, you've got the highest union membership that this country's ever had, and it was still only in the 30% range, I think.
Yeah.
And as quickly as it got that high, Republicans started going hammer and tongs, trying to knock it back down again. Because, see, what you're talking about isn't necessarily good for business. Corporate America sees no problem with America as it presently is constituted.
I know.
Because they don't have to give a good goddamn about whether somebody can feed their family. They'll just get someone else. Oh, and by the way, earlier in the evening at this Clavering rally in PA, the following quote from Trump. David in South Carolina, Stan, sent this along saying, if he loses, he ain't leaving.
Maybe if we really like it a lot and if things keep going like they're going, we'll go and we'll do what we have to do. We'll do a 3 and a 4 and a 5.
Jesus. I assume those are Arabic numerals.
No, they were spelled out, but that, yeah.
Now,
you know, this is one of those points where I have to come up, I have to acknowledge what I've said in the past, and I either stay true to my opinion, or I flip-flop. And that is the idea of presidential term limits.
Well, now, where do you, I don't think I've ever heard your feelings of that.
I despise it. It is the most anti-democratic amendment ever passed to the Constitution of the United States. Period.
I would be inclined to agree, but with this proviso, I don't think that an unlimited possibility of re-election would be such a great idea with Mr. Trump.
No, it's a nightmare. It would have been a nightmare with Reagan. But the thing is, if you are committed to ideas of democracy, then term limits are hateful to you.
Well, yeah, okay. Then I definitely
I don't
agree
support
with you.
Congressional. You know, the term limits fad was initiated by the Republicans back when they were not in the majority, and they wanted to be. So the whole idea of seniority in the Congress is predicated on you doing a good enough job to be returned there by your constituents. And their right to vote your ass out if you're not. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that's predicated on is that you won't dummy up the system with a bunch of damn gerrymandering. Okay?
Yeah.
But in a democratic system, artificial term limits are hateful. And they're hateful as to senators, hateful as to members of the House, and hateful as to the presidency. But, he won't make it to the end. Look, I acknowledge, and I've said this all along, his crimes have become so numerous and so obvious.
Don't forget Odious.
and odious that ignoring them puts the country at greater peril than having him for a second term.
Yeah. Well, sooner or later,
that's what it feels like. If he gets away with all of this, somebody else is going to come along and get away with even worse. And we tend to forget we're still under a state of emergency, Scott.
Oh, yeah.
And that state of emergency may well be sufficient for him to try to cancel the 2020 elections. And it's already being bandied about. I retweeted an article from The Atlantic over the weekend that dealt with that issue.
No, wait a minute. I don't recall Lincoln canceling elections, did he?
No.
During the Civil War, I don't recall who was president during World War I. Wilson? I don't think he tried to cancel elections.
No, they just used other ham-fisted tactics to try to affect the outcome. Things like suspension of habeas corpus and threatening to put politicians and judges in prison.
Lincoln did that.
Wilson used everything at his disposal to stop resistance to the U.S. participation in the First World War. So there's
that. That First World War, that was the one that was going to make the world safe for democracy.
That's what he said. That's what he said.
That was how they sold it. How'd that work out, kids?
Yeah. That's just one of those, leather elbow patches on the corduroy jacket and two fingers of bourbon in a highball glass discussions where it's kind of weird to realize that if the Germans actually enter Paris in 1914, you probably don't get Adolf Hitler.
You know what I think, Bob? I think I need to win the Powerball for $500 million, $750 million, so I can self-finance either my run for the presidency or what the hell, we'll run you.
No, you won't.
Why not? Come on. Where's your spirit of adventure?
Oh, no, thank you. If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve.
Well, see, the thing is, though, you've got a lot on the ball. The very least you can do is be an advisor in some important position.
Maybe. You know? But sooner or later, I'd tell whoever was president that they were a fucking idiot and walk out the door. So,
Well, that goes with the job, Bob. Come on.
One minute, you're the host of a tiny little radio program, and the next thing you know, you're being fired by a guy who sells meat through the mail.
But here's the deal. I mean, you've, not in so many words, but you've made it clear when you've disagreed with me in terms of my thinking and connecting points and things. I don't see where that's a big deal. I mean, that's what makes the country great in a capital G sort of great way. Is the fact that all of us can have our own take on things. The only problem where that system breaks down is when the take is a non-reality based take, where your source material
is
whatever you can pull out of your ass.
Riddle me this, Batman.
All right.
I said something a few minutes ago, and you didn't push back.
Say it again, because you got to remember, I've been up a long time. Is the
risk of having Donald Trump for a second term less than the risk of whatever comes after if we don't impeach him now?
I think either way it would be instructive. Either we impeach him or he doesn't serve a second term. Hey, listen, I've got a few bucks set aside. I ought to go get one of the bookies in Vegas. I don't think he's going to make the end of the first term, to be honest with you, given his age, given his state of health never mind what that crazy doctor has said, or who was the...
That was a couple of crazy doctors.
Yeah, the crazy doctor.
The hippie dude in Manhattan, and then Dr. Ronnie the Candy Man in D.C.
Yeah, never mind what they say.
Adderall the Ronnie.
The state of his health, not just physical, look at his diet, okay, for Christ's sake, but look at the state of his mind.
Well, considering I'm a guy who knocked down a rack of baby back ribs, let's not bring diet into it just now, thanks.
Well, I heard about, was this your over the weekend cooking?
Yes.
Grilling? Yes. I was salivating, Bob.
I did a different thing this time through. I made the brine. That's 2 gallons mm-hmm. of water and basically 2 cups of salt.
Mercy.
It's not as bad as it sounds. You dissolve that, then I throw in my proprietary blend of 11 herbs and spices. But I modified it this time through, and I poured in a can of pineapple juice.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you poured in a can of Wins Friction Proof, you know, that engine.
No, I didn't add a can of powdered graphite either.
Yeah, or STP.
But I did
cooler, cleaner, quieter, longer.
No, they marinated in the brine for something like 30 hours.
Mm.
And all the flavor.
That's serious marinating, Bob.
Oh, just the flavor was unbeatable. And I even one of the slabs I tinkered with, and I added some garam masala. Garam masala, Indian spice blend,
ooh,
to my rub, and wow, perked it right up.
Oh, I'm sure. You must have your palate or taste buds or whatever it is that can burn when you eat spicy things. You're probably immune. Or no, you said you get a kick. It releases so many endorphins.
Yeah, there's a little endorphin kick, but there's no further negative. There's no negative effects or anything. Shit's good for you.
No. Mercy.
I mean,
I'm sweating just thinking about hot.
You can make your own homemade capsules of cayenne pepper, and just swallow them, and you'll never know of any heat, because that all happens in your mouth.
Yeah, and there is a health benefit to that,
yeah.
Isn't there?
Lowers,
but I forget what it is.
Lowers blood pressure.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, but no, what I was getting at is when I went off, you know, when I went off on the tangent there, you were talking about. You got to be careful what you say. I mean. There's a little 20-something young woman who is apparently going up the river here in West Virginia for having issued a threat on the life of the president. Just Agnes sent me that story earlier. That's not what I'm talking about. But the fact of the matter is, he probably doesn't have great blood pressure. And... It's pretty obvious that he doesn't handle stress at all well.
Well, look on the website for Big Macs and for KFC and tell me how much sodium you see, Bob, and fat. Not the good fat, but the bad fat.
Well, and see, I've got an answer here from Steve in New York. What's worse, reelecting him after impeaching him or doing nothing? Obama made a very serious mistake in not holding Bush et al. For their responsible for their war crimes and crimes of aggression. I argue that lack of action laid a precedent for not impeaching Trump. To also not do this to Trump renders the Constitution meaningless. Lee in New York says, my fear is the next popular Republican narcissist who knows how to use government. Our only saving grace is the pale-eyed peacock does not care about law. What if someone gets the office who distracts the media and crafts legislation? Then we're doomed, Bob. So, cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
which is a dangerous phrase to be using with people wanting to start shooting at Iran.
Well, and see, where does that come from? That seemed to come up out of nowhere. I mean, Bolton, yeah, he's got his ear. But it was like nobody was even talking about that. Nobody, you know. Like I said, I haven't been following things for the better part of a week. Has Iran been rather like playing it cool, not responding?
Well, no. After this weekend threat to end Iran,
yeah,
you know, like he's some sort of schoolyard bully. Iran responded and said, "Never insult an Iranian. Be respectful." But then along the way, they got in a dig and they called Bolton and Pompeo the B team. So there was a story out there last week that four of the negotiators who met in Vietnam with the Trump regime from North Korea. Yeah, when they got home without a deal, Kim Jong Bad Golf Pants had them murdered.
Oh, Jesus.
And so, lo and behold, Mike Pompeo, who first in his class at West Point, you know, was asked about it on one of the Sunday shows. The fucker smirked. Smiled.
Well, regarding the saber rattling?
No, regarding the four his four opposites who were murdered.
Oh.
He thought it was funny.
Jeez.
So.
Well, like I say, it's not just Trump. It's the people that he has chosen to surround himself with which he is whatever is grammatically correct. It's a nest. It's a nest of nastiness, Bob. Wasn't there a song in the 60s, Ball of Confusion? It's even worse than a ball of confusion. There's something stinky at the center of it.
Maybe.
Genesis
did a highly regarded animated tune called Land of Confusion. The video was very popular. Because it had puppets of, like, Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan.
The point I'm making, though, Bob, is, you know, it's not just Trump. It's the people that he surrounds himself with. And it's the deniers and naysayers and enablers and sycophants. In the Senate that won't lift a finger to do the right thing, you know, and now he's like kind of sort of packed the Supreme Court and he's getting federal judges into position as fast as he can sign the papers to nominate them and get them, you know, rubber stamped by the Senate. It's a ball of nastiness, Bob. And it's, you know, it's like worse than Limburger cheese. I know there's a cheese that's even stinkier than Limburger at the center of it. And that's what we're dancing with. That is what we are contending with or trying to contend with. And I don't know that it's necessarily helpful. What is the count now? Up to 24, 25 have announced on the Democratic side?
Oh, yeah.
I sent you an email. I said, you know, there are more people officially. It's official. There are more people who are running as Democrats for the 2020 presidency than the 90s when talk shows were big. You couldn't swing a cat without hitting somebody.
What was it, 88? It was the Seven Dwarfs.
And what? Yeah. Seven people running for president? That's just crazy.
And then in 16, wasn't there like 19 of them or on the Republican side? And Trump, to hear him tell it, he whittled them down and whittled them all away and prevailed. I mean, who would have thought that was possible? And thank you, by the way, Joe and Mika, for your kind assistance in that endeavor.
Oh, please. Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, yeah, Clarence tells us, Ball of Confusion, The Temptations, 1968, big hit.
Yeah, I thought so. I couldn't remember which group it was, but I remembered the song title.
Yeah,
and it's not a bad song, as I recall.
Yeah, Jimmy nailed it, and so did Tracy.
Well, there you go. You got the smartest audience on the planet, Bob.
It's a hell of a lot easier to do this on this side than it would be to... I don't know if it's easier or not. I mean, if you're Limbaugh, you can just chew up a handful of OxyContins for the refreshing burst of flavor. Wait for the butterflies to start flying around in your little noggin and just lie your ass off for 3 hours a day. Just make shit up.
Well, you got to remember, though, all the news stories about Limbaugh talk about his weekly audience of 12 to 15 million.
Five.
Well, the last time I checked, let's say it's 10 million, just for argument's sake. What's the population of the country right now? About 330 million?
Thereabouts. Yeah, 133rd.
So if you're bragging of your massive audience of 10 million people, that doesn't take
into
account.
Well, right. I mean, because during the high, what's his name? Falafel guy, O'Reilly.
Oh God!
When he was at the height of his viewership, which was the biggest cable news channel viewership in the country, he got his ass handed to him every night by SpongeBob.
Mm-hmm. And you know who else he got? Who handed O'Reilly his ass? But on the radio was. Here's another videotape that I didn't even know I had that I watched as I was doing housework this week. The HBO documentary from, I guess, 2007 or 8 or 9, thereabouts, Left of the Dial. It's the story of Air America. Did you ever listen to Air America?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, it was sort of ahead of its time in a way.
But it was so far behind the curve in so many others. I mean, they were doomed from the start because they were leasing time on towers.
Oh, I know. But the intent of it was, one of the main things that they talk about in the documentary was, the radio dial is overwhelmed by the right... politically right approach to conversation and talk radio. How is it that the left hasn't had its voice heard?
Oh, that's
Randy Rhodes used to beat Bill O'Reilly's ass consistently in terms of ratings in New York.
Oh, and the thing is, most so-called progressive talkers wound up on flickering candle flame signals while the right-wing assholes had the 50,000-watt clear-channel blowtorches.
Well, we had KLSD here in San Diego, and it was on a respectable signal. I mean, they were running a good 10,000 watts in the daytime on the upper end of the AM dial, and if you look at their map, their coverage map, it covered a lot of ground. And this is the insanity of Clear Channel going back to that time. The station was pulling numbers. I think that the format that it replaced when Air America came on, it was pop standards, music of your life, big bands, and that. That station was pulling numbers that it had never pulled in its history.
Right, so it had to go.
But the thing is, they replaced it with a fucking sports station making the third or fourth sports station in the market.
Yes.
And they have yet to reach the number that
do you think they do you think they wanted to?
Money, I mean,
no,
if you can,
no, no. If you're a clear channel and you've got a bunch of blowtorches and they're making money, you got to balance that against some that you set up to lose. And none of those and none of those geniuses ever thought that progressive radio would succeed. And so the minute that it started succeeding, oh shit, it's making money.
It did in San Diego. It did in Portland, Oregon. It did once they got a station in L.A. I don't know how they were doing in New York.
Yeah, and they didn't want to succeed. I mean, remember? I mean, if you watch that Air America documentary, do you remember the great advertising memo kerfuffle?
Well, I remember that they were getting pretty good responses. They were.
No, there was a memo that went around that said, "Do not run ads on any Air America station."
Oh, yeah. That I remember. But the network, fledgling as it was, out of the gate was billing fairly decent numbers, money wise, and would have grown had it been given even a marginal chance.
That's what I'm trying to get through, Scott. It wasn't supposed to have that chance. The fundamental fuck up that was involved with Air America was the fact that they did not buy any goddamn stations. The smart money would have been to buy stations on the cheap in busted knuckle and left elbow.
Well, yeah, that makes sense.
Because whatever the content in those little local markets, a radio station license is a license to print money.
Oh, I know.
And it doesn't matter whether it's Rush or Randy. As long as the local avail rolls around and you got, yeah, come on down to Freddy's Texaco. We got a free car wash with a fill-up. There's a lot going on down here.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's money. But they didn't want the money. And the whole vile, vicious feuding and infighting that took and the ripoffs. I mean, the money they were paying. They were hemorrhaging $80,000 a day.
Well, and yeah, that was one of the problems. The people that started it didn't capitalize it in any meaningful way, and there were some shenanigans, from what I recall. Besides,
and if you own outright 50 stations in 50 small local markets, and you've got a bunch of little nerds from the AV club in the high school who are working part-time, running syndicated programming, and mostly they're just sitting there babysitting a board.
Yeah.
You can't help but make money, and you will get your message out.
On the other hand,
if you're paying a bajillion dollars a year to Al Franken alone to run a show that's going across on stations where you're buying time on the schedule,
yeah,
you're doomed.
Well, Bob, as you were speaking a moment ago, I had a moment of clarity and insight. Here's what I need to do with the half a billion or three quarters of a billion dollars.
Buy radio stations.
Sure. Where do you know any properties that are nice and juicy and available where you live?
Not where I live, but they're around. They can be found.
I can think of a few that I know of in markets.
And you know what? If it's in rural PA or rural Ohio or rural Alabama, Who gives a shit? Because what it comes down to is competing in the marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And what gave these broadcast executives the turtle squirts was that it was competing. And it was changing minds.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of something for everybody. You know, Randy was there. Franken was there. Malloy was there.
Oh, Mark Maron was there.
Mark Maron, Sam Cedar.
Rachel. I couldn't believe I was looking at Rachel Maddow doing radio because she looked like she was 12. I mean, she's already youthful looking anyway. But her hair was different. She was sort of a buzz cut on the sides and a clump of hair on top.
You know, Arnold tells me there are stations for sale all over the country. And for instance, the money that, say, Tom Steyer is throwing into his petition to impeach ads. A year of that money would change the political landscape of this country.
Yeah, I mean, it would be dollars well spent. So that's what I need to do. I need to win the fucking Powerball for half a billion or three quarters of a billion and sit down with you, and you can probably hook me up with people, and I know a few people, and map it out. All from sea to shining sea, let's have a progressive voice.
And Brother Deacon, Brother Deacon Asa points out, in addition to all the other hurdles, station ownership et al., most syndication shops such as Westwood One, TRN, Premier, yeah, etc., are owned by feverish, frothing-at-the-mouth right-wingers.
Yeah. Well, Premier, isn't that a Clear Channel, or what are they?
Yeah, that's right, and that's the old, that's the home of the Excellence in Broadcasting Network, which really doesn't exist.
No. And it's gold-plated microphone.
Golden microphone.
Yeah.
Randy tells me iHeartRadio shares are selling for $1 a share, junk territory, and the stations themselves may be available for a song.
Well, there's a number of broadcast companies like Salem. Its stock is real low. iHeart is real low. Cumulus ain't doing too well. I kind of keep track of stuff, even though I've been away from the business for some years. But
yeah, Lee in New York says Air America was low power in New York City. Air America was low power and so far off the high frequency end of the band that you had to give two more turns when you reached the end.
Well, wait a minute. They were on WLIB, which I believe was 1600, and I think they were running 50,000 watts or 25,000 daytime. As a matter of fact, the company that owned them, that Air America was leasing from, also owned WoWo in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana, which was a big honking top 40 station that you could hear at night all over the country back in the 60s and into the 70s. And when they bought it, they wanted to raise WLIB, or 1190 maybe it was. They wanted to raise WLIB's power, but in order to do that, they had to petition the commission to decrease WoWo's power. I don't know. I'll have to read up on that. It's been some years since I was conversant in it. But, yeah, maybe that's the way to go. Buy radio.
I would be remiss if I didn't point out to you that some of the conventional wisdom is that radio is simply dead, especially on the AM band.
You think? I don't know about that.
Well,
they've been trying to bury it for 90 years, Bob.
If I'm driving through D.C., the AM band is two things. Jesus channels and Hispanic music channels and some Hispanic talk.
Yeah.
It's about all there is. Now, there is one radio station that's operated by an arm of the Russian government.
Oh, yeah. The 1390. RT. When I was growing up, it was type 40, or top 40. Weem. And they got fined or shut down or something.
Well, they were recently compelled to register as a foreign agent.
That's it.
And
yeah.
They didn't like it. But,
well,
yeah, whatever.
Well, listen, I'm going to go because we've covered every base. We've made up bases that I didn't even know about before I called that we were going to cover. Mercy. It's always an energizing endeavor to visit with you, Bob, and the Horn listeners who are on the same wavelength, and they can fill in knowledge gaps for me and
you. Oh, and by the way, Billable Rick says another song similar to what Scott mentioned. Let's not forget that apropos 60s song, The Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire. Oh, dadgummit. I don't know why it did it, but it did. And it dropped the Bluetooth. That's so annoying. We'll be back there in a minute. Give me a minute, Scott. Bear with me. There you are.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Eve of Destruction. Oh, they played the grooves off of that record when I was a kid.
And he. Barry McGuire came over, went solo after, I think, the New Christy Minstrels.
What was his real name? That was he had roots in the D.C. area. He was pals with Cass Elliott and John Phillips and,
You mean Barry McGuire wasn't his real name?
Yeah. No, it was something Blomstein or... somebody can Google it. They'll let us know. I believe he hailed from Arlington, Virginia.
Well, let's ask Mr. Google.
Hello, Mr. Google. How are you today? I know there's a Blom, B-L-O-M, in there.
No, I don't.
No, wait a minute. I've got a computer. I can look at.
No, there's nothing.
Well, hang on here. Give me a moment, Bob, and I'll see what I can find.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the wiki on him, and nothing in there about him having. I mean, Barry McGuire is a pretty weird name to change your name to.
No, that was a great name.
I remember playing him during the Progressive Hour when I was at the little gospel radio station.
I may be thinking of somebody else.
I think you are.
Who am I thinking of? Of that era. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And there's another singer of that era. Oh, and that's going to bug the hell out of me. Because I can't even think of a song that person would be famous for.
No, nope, I think he is and always has been Barry McGuire.
Yeah, you're right. I'm thinking possibly Scott McKenzie. Maybe that's who I'm thinking. Yeah, Philip Wallach Blondheim was Scott McKenzie's actual birth name. Sorry, I'm a little fritzy because I've been up too long and I've been drinking gallons and gallons of cheap coffee, Bob. I'm wired. I'm picking up Radio Liberty, for Christ's sake. Jeez.
Well, it's not doing any apparent harm.
Oh, good. Maybe I need to do this all the time before I call. Stay up for 24 hours.
Yeah, just get nice and loopy. Lee in New York points out, at 48 years of music, 95.5 FM WPLJ is closing and going Christian.
Oh, yeah. And as I recall, they have a respectable signal. You know who else Salem, that religious broadcasting group, owns and they've owned them for, 30 years now. One of the early all-news stations, not just in D.C., but in the country, was WAVA, W-A-V-A, licensed to Arlington at 780 on AM and 105.1 on FM. And WAVA FM was a rock and it was a rock station, but it was like a contemporary rock station. And they had the best damn signal in the city of Washington, the area. The only station that has a better signal on FM is DC 101. But Salem, it has ruined that station with their religious bullshit. And now they're looking to do the same for WLPJ.
You know, it's interesting. Arnold, who knows whence he speaks, said a few minutes ago, there's no centralized left-wing media in this country. If we went right-wing, it would be paid for houses and new trucks all around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why why we survive the way we do. I mean, I loathe talking about fundraising on this program. I mentioned it at the beginning of the program and didn't say anything more about it. We're 14 minutes from the end, you know, bupkis. But thanks to Charlene for re-upping her subscription. Thank you, Charlene, very, very kindly. Charlene let me know that her card had been hacked or something, and she was in the process of setting up a new one. But, what a nightmare. What a nightmare that is. And I guess, there are billions of dollars in that fraudulent transaction business is... It's a going concern. But thank you to Charlene in Rhode Island. And hopefully we'll knock down some of the fundraising along the way. I mean, I hate it. I wish, I actually think about going, but they've eliminated greeters at Walmart. And so, welcome to Walmart. I love you.
Well, I felt bad this month, Bob. I know you're not, and I'm just saying, personally speaking, this month has been hellacious because I do my annual dance with the state paying my Part B premium, and then when they do, I make too much money, and then they don't, and then I've got to jump through hoops. But in the case, as always, they stopped paying it in the end of February, which meant in May, the premium for March, the one for April, and the one for May got paid by yours truly, which is a considerable chunk taken out of an already somewhat meager disability check. But I'm hopefully someone carried my portion this month, and if they didn't, I would invite them to seriously look at doing that. And I'll be back on track in June. And I know you weren't aiming any of the fundraising at me, but I'm just saying that it bothers me that shit happens. And this was one of those months where I couldn't. Because really, that's if everybody does a little, A, the need gets met, and B, the program continues as a resource. We don't want to see Bob in an orange vest at Walmart.
Ew.
You know? Or blue vest. What do they wear?
Blue. Unless blue, you're management, okay. Unless you're management, then you get yellow.
No, we don't need that.
But, I mean, my Wally World, they just replaced a shit ton of cashiers with those self-checkouts.
Yeah, I will not use them. The grocery store I go to is a Union grocery store, Ralph's.
Yeah, I pay more to go to Kroger's, but I try to get as much as I can there.
Well, and see, the thing is, Bob, unions have been so decimated in this country in the last 35 or 40 years that, if nothing else, and I hope there is something else. But if nothing else, at the very least, the most we can do at this point is to support union jobs whenever we can.
Absolutely. You know? And I make a point of saying, hey, I'm in here because I support union jobs.
Yeah. And they appreciate it because they know that we see the value. We honor their labor, in other words. We honor what unions do and have done historically in this country.
And look, make no mistake, it comes at a cost. Okay? I pay more to go to Kroger's and support those union jobs. But it's worth it. Because those are families with a fighting chance.
Yeah. Yeah. A decent wage, decent benefits, decent working conditions, and some honor attached to what they're up to. That's the American way.
But if I ever find out who put through the recent reset at my Kroger, we're going out back.
What do you mean reset?
They rearranged the whole damn store.
Oh, they do that just to keep you on your toes.
Nothing
Bob.
Is where. Well, I mean, this they hadn't messed with this one in a long time, and so I'm wandering around in there like I've never been in there before.
Yeah,
the coffee's in the wrong place. God only knows where the cat food is.
Yeah. Well, they're doing that at the big Target that I usually go to in Mission Valley. I went in there, the last two times I've gone in there, it's like I all of a sudden became a moron.
Yes.
Wandering, pushing the cart up and down aisles that used to have...
I ran into a sweet, it's always cute when the sweet little old ladies let go with some sailor talk.
Oh, good.
Because I was wandering up and down the aisles trying to find something that wasn't where it was supposed to be.
Can't find a fucking thing in this store.
And this sweet little old lady, I said, are you as lost as I am? She said, all I want is a can of fucking pie filling. Where the fuck is it? And I had one of those spit take moments.
Yeah.
Because it was not looked for. And so I felt that sense of camaraderie that attaches to you when you've got two people in an equally miserable situation. So I said, "Well, come on, we'll find it."
Yeah, yeah.
And we looked. And so eventually she looks. They've got it. It turns out it's down on the lowest shelf where she has to break a hip to get to it.
Yeah.
And she goes, "Well, I'll be damned."
Yeah, and it's like you're finding the Comstock load when you find what you went in there to get. And you know what, Bob? That is not the most ideal and advantageous retail environment. When you have people mumbling and saying to one another in the aisles, hell, don't follow me, I'm lost too.
They managed to keep the deli and the deli and the bakery in the same place, and the fresh fruits and veggies apparently didn't bother the marketing genius, but everything and the meats and the weenies and everything else was fair game.
Yeah, well, over the years, over the last eight
why the hell are
years,
the Cheerios where the Friskies used to be?
Both of the Ralph's stores, which are you may as well say Kroger, that I shop at. Both of them at different times have undergone complete transformations. And it's like being in hell, Bob. It's frustrating because you get used to stuff, and I know where this is, and you want to get in and get out as quickly as you can, and they throw a wrench into it. And you feel dumb. Because you're like, I can't find the damn instant coffee, Bob.
I know, and there have been stocking issues. my 100% Colombian Swiss water pros decaf. Somebody out there likes it as much or better than I do because they can't keep it in stock now.
Well, when you madness. When you find it, you hoard it. I mean, if you like most people.
Oh, but know, I did find something. Now, this was not that Private Selection label brand. I love that. I love that stuff. But it's El Pinto salsa.
What's it called?
El Pinto.
El Pinto.
El Pinto. And it's made with Hatch New Mexico green chilies. And they've got a version that's hot made with Hatch New Mexico red chilies. I bought both.
Is this in a jar?
Yeah, yeah. It's salsa.
Now, wait a minute.
Salsa.
El Pinto.
El Pinto.
If you hit it from behind, does it burst into flame?
Oh, God. I tell you what, it was, I had just while I was sitting here waiting for the ribs to get done yesterday, I had my my Tostitos Cantina Thin and Crispies out. The best, the best, just, you know, corporate tortilla chips there are.
Do they have Mission brand tortilla chips?
Yeah, but those are, you could shingle a house with those. They're too thick.
Well, I must try the Tostinos then because I always kind of liked
These are as thin as an egg roll wrapper.
Oh,
they're
wow.
Fantastic. And I tied into that salsa, and I mean, the endorphin rush was there. I had the sweat running down my head and everything. Oh, it was good. It's real good.
I can't remember the name, the brand name of it, but it's one of the few salsas that's refrigerated in the store.
Oh, I've seen that. I've seen that. That's not bad, but this stuff was the best I've had in a while.
Well, I'll look for it because I'm sure if Kroger has it, then Ralph's probably has it. Now the trick is to find it in the rearranged store.
Oh, Jesus! I thought I was halfway to New Mexico by the time I found where the salsa was.
Well, and next time you'll have to go. You know, another one that I haven't had for years. There's a black bean dip that has actual black beans in it, and I don't know what else. And it's refrigerated.
I love that stuff sometimes. Yeah, that's really good, too.
Oh, God. Now I'm hungry for salsa.
Oh, and I got some soft yellow corn tortillas for making homemade, the Mick Jagger pronunciation, quesadillas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want a quesadilla?
Yeah.
Got some of the, you know, the crumbly Mexican cheese and some of the shredded four cheese Monterey Jack, a homemade quesadilla, which is just a south of the border grilled cheese. I mean, come on,
yeah.
And the perfect snacking with some of that salsa, yeah. There we go.
Yeah, you know, if worse comes to worse and I can't make it in California anymore, I want to come live with you all because you all eat good, you know.
Well, it's a matter of being cheap and creative at the same time. Like, you know, those rib slabs I found were on sale because I, you know, just kind of haunt the expiration dates and stuff.
Yeah,
and you know, so I got. I spent $20 and got four slabs of ribs.
Well, there you go.
And
smart shopper, Bob.
Yeah, can't get one for that money in a restaurant.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know the spring is come and almost gone in another 4 weeks?
Yep.
5 weeks.
I'll start grieving on the summer solstice.
Yeah, but.
The shortening of days.
Yeah, I know. But see, you're looking at it wrong. I understand that. But, you know, didn't you say this was the first weekend that it's been decent enough to where you could go out and. Well, there you go. It's the first of many weekends, Bob.
Right. And I'll be cooking to beat the band in advance of heading down to Malloy Fest.
Oh, when is that, in June?
Yeah, Yeah, 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Well, I wish I could make it. That sounds like fun. The last time you went, it sounded like more fun than people should be allowed to have, Bob.
It was a lot of fun, and hopefully we won't get poured on this time, and it'll be even more, and it'll be warm and stuff. By the way, recommendation coming from Dowhead in the chat room, Mrs. Renfro's black bean salsa is near crack. There you go. Hey, Scott, have yourself a good evening. I'm glad you survived your review.
Well, I am too, Bob, and as always, it's been a lovely way to spend a late afternoon.
It's been a very pleasant way to round out the first part of the evening here. So you
okay?
Listen, lay off the sauce for a little bit, and by sauce I mean the Java. I mean I know it's freeze dried and all of that, but you know.
Well, I'm coffeed up. I my next cup won't be till sometime Thursday. So. If I'm able to sleep tonight, I'll consider it a miracle. I may have to call TBN to the prayer counselors and get them to pray me to sleep.
Well, good luck with that. I don't know what that's going for these days.
Who knows? I'm flakier than grandmother's pie crust, Bob. I'm here to tell you. Take care, my friend.
All right, you too. We'll talk to you later, Scott. See ya.
Okay, Bob.
Bye now. Billable Rick, 95.5 closing after 48 years. It's very strange about 95.5 closing its doors as a rock and roll station. We have a 95.5 rock radio station here in L.A. called KLOS, which just celebrated its 50th anniversary. They celebrated that day by promoting a concert with the Hollywood Vampires at the Greek Theater two Saturdays ago, which I attended with the lovely star. Long live the L.A. 95.5 station. Hear, hear. And a note to round things out from Lady B. For years, the media told us what to care about, you know, the shit that really matters. Now that they've successfully diverted our attention, their myth that we don't seem to care about, you guessed it, the stuff that really matters. We media folks, former and current, are all complicit. We were taught that by appealing to feelings, emotional and sexual or otherwise, we could capture the brass ring of relevance, all the while pleasing our capitalistic overlords. Remember when each newscast started ending with kickers? Hey, it's happy talk. We also did it because smug self-satisfaction among the educated is a hell of a drug. We can read. We look good. We deliver the news in an expensive outfit and a gleam in our eye. She can tell you about the plane crash with a gleam in her eye. It's interesting when people die. Give us dirty laundry. You dumb fucks love stories about puppies. Yeah, Ford laid off 7,000 employees, and we may start a needless war with Iran, but look at the royal baby. That makes you more likely to watch the news if you know you get a cute story at the end. Why watch the sad news if there's no happy ending? So, we're the media's slaves, educated or not. The news and television in general is titillating because it sells. We get high on the supply of outrage. And as for the less enlightened, they can escape into televised crap rather than face the fact that they're in their kids' lives. Are in shambles. Anyway, that Joe Bagent guy sounds fascinating. Go and find his archives, his essay archives online. JoeBagent.com is where it used to be. You'll just have to look. BAGEANT. America, Why Your Peeps Be So Dumb. One of the great essays of our time. Speaking of literacy, my great-grandfather, a sharecropper, posed for an amazing picture with an open book on his lap. That meant he was literate. My mother emphasized education and always tried to enunciate her words carefully. We made fun of her. But that is why all her kids talk all proper like a white person and shit. It worked. It means something. People give you more of the benefit of the doubt. Knowledge is power. You may not know what dihydrogen monoxide is by its scientific name, or even that our numbers actually came from the Arabic system. I did. Yay. But at least you should know that a smart aleck asshole is asking you that in front of a camera while standing on a busy street corner. I'm doing it for a reason. Knowledge also tells you when it's time to admit you made a mistake and it's time to move on or fix it. No more tax cuts for the rich. Vote for shit that will help your immediate needs and your future needs. Feed and vaccinate your kids. That way they'll contribute to a healthy planet and your social security. house the homeless, because that shit couldn't that shit could happen to you too. And don't separate kids from their parents, because then you create terrorists. Sorry for the soliloquy. Do not apologize. But I've been thinking about this over the weekend, so it was really cool you opened up the show with your thoughts about education and literacy in America. We should be a frickin' utopia over here. Billionaires who pay off one graduating class of student loans are very cool, but it would be even cooler if they all pledged to fund all public schools equally, offering everyone a chance, hell, to eventually work for them, I guess. We need to demand that those with more do more. Remind billionaires they don't build that road or water system by themselves. That shit was started and funded by people before you. Same with the libraries where you learned your craft. Give back. Educate kids. Teach them all Spanish and Chinese from kindergarten on. Make us better citizens of the world. Let us be the shining city on the hill for the world, not just your gated community. As for the rest of us, not above average intelligence, those who claim to be should do our damnedest to make sure they get the assistance they need. Christ's sakes, y'all, that's what a true Christian does. It's the very definition of the measures of a man. It's what Jesus wanted. There's only one earth we know about. We are our brother's keepers. Let's act like it. Thanks for all you do, Bob. You may not be a pimp, but I'm sure you speak of the pompous of love. Very well. Signed, the Midnight Toker, Lady B. Pompous. By God. Maybe, well, once again, this may be the only radio program that had pompous in it this evening throughout the entire radio landscape. Oh, and by the way, one last thing. On the way out the door, a little something I noticed today. We had a story a few weeks back all about how a federal judge had thrown out a prosecution of a doctor in Michigan who transported little girls across state lines for the purpose of mutilating their genitals. You see, we have a statute, have had for about 20 years, that forbids the practice of female genital mutilation. It is as brutal a practice as can be found anywhere on the planet. And I will not go into the gory details because they are goddamn well gory. We were doing pretty good with our little with our little ban on female genital mutilation. But a right-wing judge got hold of the case, the criminal prosecution of the doctor who took the little girls to have their genitals mutilated. And he declared it was unconstitutional. You might have missed this in all the other many little instances of the 15 millisecond news cycle fire hose. But the Trump administration has declared that they have no interest in defending that piece of legislation. That was a decision that was made in the office of the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, or one of his immediate minions. Let that soak in. He won't enforce subpoenas issued by the Congress. He won't compel the Treasurer of the United States to obey a law that is so crystal clear as to be virtually unchallengeable. And now he will not defend a law meant to protect little girls from having their genitals carved up by sick, brutal, misogynistic bastards. He will not send a lawyer into a court to argue that, yes, that statute
is constitutional.
He won't do anything about children kept in cages, and yeah, we killed another one. This one was 15 years old, found unresponsive in the concentration camp. But he will jump like the froggy he appears to be at the first ignorant burp out of Donald Trump's mouth. One of these days. Well, I don't know if there's going to be a one of these days. We have to be smart enough not to lose our minds over purity wars. And we have to have enough, we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Because, see, once impeachment is joined, what we'll get then is a steady litany of, oh, why are the Democrats impeaching Trump? Obviously, they don't have the... It's almost like we're being played. Wait. We are. But I wanted to make sure that that story got some light, even at the end of the program. Because it takes a vicious, sickening sack of shit to leave little girls to the tender mercies of butchers and not defend a statute that protects them in court. Wow. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air. Thank you very kindly to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you earlier in the evening to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to Steve from Georgistan. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. And remember, the easiest way to get the podcast, either for Dr. Bill or me, is simply to go to podcast.headon.live. Can't get any simpler than that. Thanks to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.